Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's MLB Seasonal Awards Podcast. My name's John Zagluel, owner and operator of the site. We have a lot to get to today. We're going to be analyzing each of the races going on right now in each of the MLB Seasonal Awards. We'll take a look at each of the finalists and then make some picks of who we think will end up winning. And later in the show, we'll also have a special guest, and he'll give his input as to who he thinks will win all of these awards. They're going to be announced next week. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ShyTalkSports. Hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at JohnZack. And finally, if you're looking for a place here in the Tinley Park area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, head to the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World. You can contact them at 708-247-2100 or visit them yourself in the Downing Shopping Center at 7913 171st Street in Tinley Park, Illinois. Well, let's get started right away. We'll start with the NL Manager of the Year. The three finalists right now are Torey Lovullo for the Diamondbacks, Bud Black for the Rockies, and Dave Roberts for the Dodgers. And wow, how do you like that? They're all from the NL West. Isn't that a bit odd? But nevertheless, let's take a look at each of them and see who deserves to win the award. First, we start with Torey Lovullo, and he's quite an interesting story. He was the bench coach for a number of years with the Boston Red Sox, and last year when now former manager John Farrell was diagnosed with cancer, he had to take a leave of absence, so he let Lovullo end up being the manager for that time. And in that time period, he did very well, which cemented his status to become a full-time manager that next season. Sure enough, the Diamondbacks took a chance on him. I mean, what did they have to lose, right? The year before, D-backs could barely win 70 games. They had lots of problems, especially in their starting rotation. And then, of course, they had injuries. I mean, A.J. Pollock was out for the entire season with a broken elbow. But nevertheless, Lovullo came over, and this season he's been doing unbelievable. The team won 93 games. That's even one more than the Chicago Cubs, by the way. And they took the first wild card spot. Of course, they did get swept in the playoffs to the Dodgers, but to think that the Dodgers ended up going to the World Series, I mean, that kind of means something right there. You lose to the best. So he had a great season, and that was only his first year in Arizona. I can only imagine what he's going to do now as his contract progresses, and hopefully he can help the team get further and further along in the playoffs. Then we've got Bud Black, and he is such a veteran, such a good manager from the beginning. He was a former winner of the award with the San Diego Padres. I believe it was back in 08. So he's on the ballot once again. And kind of the same situation with Lovullo. Of course, the backstory is different, but he came to a team who has been historically bad. I mean, in the past 5 years, both the Diamondbacks and the Rockies have combined for only one playoff appearance, and that was the Diamondbacks way back in the early 2010s. So anyway, Bud Black comes over, really revamps the starting rotation because he was a former pitcher himself, former pitching coach before he became a manager. He really especially helped out John Gray, who was transformed now into the Rockies ace. And he ended up managing that team to make it all the way to the playoffs, getting the second wild card spot. They did lose in the wild card game, but still, that was the first time there was playoff baseball for the Colorado Rockies since 2008. So something very significant in franchise history has occurred, and that's why Bud Black is on the list. And then finally, we've got Dave Roberts, second season at the helm with the Los Angeles Dodgers, and he did much better than his first season, winning over 100 games. They had the best record in baseball. They made it all the way to Game 7 of the World Series before losing. But Roberts, I give the guy credit because with the roster so stacked, you have to find ways to make everything fit, right? How am I going to make a lineup with all these great players and stuff like that? And Roberts was able to balance it well, helping the Dodgers get all the way to Game 7. So you have to give him some props as well. Sure, he may have had all the horses, but it doesn't mean anything if you can't put the right horses in the right spots. So as far as who is most deserving, who I think should win, I think Torey Lovullo should win only because of his story. This is his first year as being a full-time manager, and he led the Diamondbacks from the cellar all the way to the very first wildcard spot, and an NLDS appearance, I think that's a very big deal, and I think Torey Lovullo, therefore, should win NL Manager of the Year. So now we're going to shift gears to the AL Manager of the Year. Three very good, very qualified candidates. We'll start with Terry Francona, who is the reigning Manager of the Year with the Cleveland Indians. And if last season you thought, okay, yeah, he did well, this year even better. They won 102 games in the regular season. Unfortunately, though, the Indians couldn't capture that same sort of magic in the playoffs, and they lost to the Yankees in the ALDS. But still, Francona winning 102 games with the team that was still down Michael Brantley, a former runner-up to the MVP award. That just goes to show you how talented he is as a manager, how he is able to make good in-game decisions that will pay dividends in the future. So Francona, a very strong candidate, and again, the reigning winner. Then you've got Paul Molitor with the Twins, a Hall of Famer already as a player, and in his third year with Minnesota, he led them to the playoffs. They made it to the second wild card spot, and if it wasn't for their star third baseman Miguel Sano being hurt, they probably could have actually won the wild card game over the Yankees and made it to the ALDS, so a lot of things could have been different if he was available. For Molitor, however, you have to think about the adversity that he faced as a manager all season long. I mean, the Twins got rid of their closer, Brandon Kinsler, to the Nationals at the trade deadline, and from there, management pretty much conceded the season. They said, you know what? We're not going to make the playoffs, we're not contending, so let's start shipping away some guys and getting prospects. Despite that fact, the Twins still found themselves in the race, and then you have to think about, too, that their only effective starting pitcher was Urban Santana this season. Their number two starter, Kyle Gibson, had an ERA over 7, and their fifth starter spot was a platoon split between Bartolo Colon at age 44 and Hector Santiago, who had an ERA near 6. So when factoring all of that in, it's even a surprise that the Twins were even competing until the last week of the season and then making a wild card spot on top of it. So that's just a great job of managing by Paul Molitor, and that explains why he's on the ballot. And then finally, we have the manager of the reigning world champions, the Houston Astros. It's A.J. Hinch. He's on the ballot as well, and right now, he seems like a favorite in the eyes of many, right? I mean, Hinch led his team to over 100 victories. He led his team all the way to the World Series, in which they won in 7 games. And then you have to think about the fact that all of the guys he was managing were all very young players. I mean, this team is very similar to the 2016 and 2015 Cubs teams. All these young kids just trying to make a name for themselves, and they go and win the World Series. So Hinch just does a good job of managing his talent, similar to a Dave Roberts. He does have all the horses, but it matters if you put them in the right spots. I mean, think about Marwin Gonzalez, for example. He was a former Cub in the minor leagues, comes over here to the Astros, entering the season, doesn't know if he's going to get any playing time or not. By the end of the year, ranks top 15 in the AL in OPS. So that was a decision made by Hinch to start him, and that explains why he's on this ballot as well. So if I had to pick who is going to win the AL Manager of the Year award, although I personally think Paul Molitor should get it, I think in the end A.J. Hinch will get it because of the fact that the Astros ended up winning the World Series for the first time in franchise history. I mean, that is a milestone, and you have to award the manager who led them all the way there. Back to the NL we go. Now it's NL Rookie of the Year time. Three finalists, all very qualified, although we kind of do know who's going to win in the end. But let's take a look at all of them regardless. First off, we have Paul DeJong, shortstop and second baseman for the Cardinals. And hey, he was based out of Illinois, went to Illinois State for college. How do you like that? What a great season he had. 25 homers, 65 RBIs, batted .285, which is the best batting average of any of the finalists considered for this award, and had an OPS of .857. So a really good season for Paul DeJong. Unfortunately, though, the Cardinals didn't make the playoffs. They weren't in the national media much, which is why he has not been looked at too much, but that stat line is very impressive for a rookie. So we're going to move on now to the next candidate. It's Josh Bell of the Pittsburgh Pirates. Played first base and DH to bid in AL Interleague games. Bell this season, a good year, .255 average, which is a little off-putting, but 26 homers, 90 RBIs, and 159 games. So What can you tell from that stat line? Well, one, he does need to work on his batting average, and that is definitely going to hurt him in the voters' eyes. But he does have power, he can drive in runners, and most importantly, durability. He played 159 games this season, the most games out of any candidate. Another problem for Bell, however, is the fact that he was on the Pirates, and they were nowhere near making the playoffs. I mean, at least the Cardinals stayed in it till the final week or so. So due to that lack of attention, it's going to be very hard for Bell to get some votes in this. And then finally, we have the All-Star and the most likely favorite, Cody Bellinger. This season, 132 games, 128 hits, 39 home runs, 97 RBIs, a .267 batting average. And here's the kicker, an OPS of .933, which actually ranked amongst qualified batters as far as OPS leaderboards goes. So, I mean, it's not really too much of a competition, although the other two rookies would have more consideration in other years due to the fact that Bellinger really helped the Dodgers make it all the way to the playoffs and to the World Series. It makes sense that he is going to win this award this year. So now we move on to the AL side of things. Three candidates all qualified, but there is a favorite. So we'll start with Andrew Benintendi of the Red Sox. He was a top prospect, and in his brief call-up in 2016, he really impressed, hitting .295. This year, in the context of an entire season, he did well. He didn't overwhelm with statistics, but he did good enough, right? 20 home runs, 90 RBIs, .271 average, and an OPS just over .775. Benintendi had a good season. Unfortunately, though, he didn't necessarily live up to the expectations that were put forth. This is a good season. By all means, it is. But a former top prospect, a former number one overall prospect, should probably put up more intimidating numbers than that. In any other season, I could definitely see him winning the award due to his status and due to his seasonal numbers. But because of the year that Aaron Judge put up, which we'll get to him in a minute, it's going to be very hard for Benintendi to win. Next we go to the Orioles, another AL East team. It's Trey Mancini, who is a finalist from Notre Dame, by the way. This year, a very good season for him in his second year in the big leagues. He got a little taste of the MLB in 2016, playing in only five games. But this year, in a full season, 24 homers, 78 RBIs, and a .293 batting average, which is the best batting average out of all the finalists. So he's kind of in a similar boat to DeJong for the Cardinals in the NL race. A very good season, good batting average, but again, he's going to be in the shadows of Judge because of the Orioles did not come close to making the playoffs. Then finally we get to the likely favorite, it's Aaron Judge. This season, 52 home runs, 128 runs scored, which also led the American League. His only problem was his strikeouts. We'll get to that later when we talk to him about the MVP race, because that could really hurt him. But as far as Rookie of the Year goes, he had .284. He had an OPS over 1,000. I mean, how can you not give him the award? So, yes, Aaron Judge will win the AL Rookie of the Year award by far. It'll actually probably be a unanimous decision. So now we'll get to the big awards, starting with the NL Cy Young Award. Three good pitchers, all, though, have missed at least one start this season. Very interesting. We'll get to that in a moment. So the three finalists are Clayton Kershaw of the Los Angeles Dodgers, Max Scherzer of the Nationals, and Steven Strasburg, also of the Nationals. So what I was talking about, how each pitcher has missed at least one start. It's very interesting because I specifically recall a few years back when Clayton Kershaw won, I believe it was his second Cy Young Award. He was up against Gio Gonzalez, also a Nationals pitcher. Gonzalez won 21 games. He led the league in wins, had an ERA under 3.0, but pitched 198 innings. Voters penalized him for this and did not vote for him specifically because he had durability problems. It's quite ironic, though, that this year, Kershaw and Strasburg have each pitched only 175 innings, and Scherzer barely made it to 200. So I just found that interesting, but nevertheless, let's get to qualifications. Let's see who we think is going to win. First, it's Kershaw. He's won the award three times in his career. He's won an MVP as well. This year, led the league in wins and ERA. But again, he did not lead in strikeouts nor innings pitched due to his injuries that have hurt him this year, his back problems being the major one. So, when keeping that in mind, a guy who did not even pitch in 30 games, I don't believe, in my opinion, that he should win the award because of that. But that's just me. Steven Strasburg, kind of in the same boat. 28 games, 15-4, 2.52 ERA. But again, 175 innings and 204 strikeouts. That is a problem for me. If you cannot pitch 200 innings, that proves one of two things. One, you were injured for part of the year. Or two, you're not a bona fide number one starter. Because only number ones and twos and even threes can hit the 200 inning plateau. Your fours and fives, not necessarily. And then finally, we've got Max Scherzer. This year's 16-6 record, which is okay, right? 2.51 ERA. But 268 strikeouts in only 200 innings, that's pretty impressive. He led the league in strikeouts, also led the league in whip at 0.90. That's something to consider. And also, the only pitcher on this list to eclipse the 200 inning mark, albeit barely, but still, that means more to me than simply leading the league in wins, but pitching 175 innings. So, here's what I think is going to happen. One, voters are going to look at Kershaw and see his track record, which is amazing. He also led the league in wins and ERA despite pitching only 175 innings. They're going to look at Strasburg, and I believe he'll finish third in the voting only because they'll see him as a number two to Scherzer. So it's going to come down to Kershaw or Scherzer, and what I think voters are going to do, similar in years past with Gio Gonzalez, is look at durability. Scherzer only missed one start all season, eclipsed the 200 innings mark, and had nearly 270 strikeouts. Kershaw missed 5 starts this year, pitched under 200 innings, and barely got to 200 strikeouts. With that in mind, I believe Max Scherzer will win the award this season. Shifting gears to the AL, we have 3 finalists, all very qualified. One, a former White Sox, by the way, is Chris Sale from the Boston Red Sox now, Corey Kluber from the Indians, and Luis Severino from the Yankees. We'll start with Sale. What a year he had his first year away from the South Side. 17-8 record, ERA under 3 at 2.90, led the league in innings pitched, and led the league in strikeouts with 308. That is just a shocking number. The last guy to strike out 300 batters was Clayton Kershaw back in 2015. So, Sale, what a year, right? Well, let's take a look at his last couple of months in the season. We'll start with the game on August 24th against the Indians. In that game, Sale lasted only 3 innings and gave up 6 earned runs, 7 runs total. The next start did well, but the start after that, September 3rd, 4 1/3 innings and 3 earned. Then the start on September 15th, 5 2/3, 4 earned. And then his final start of the season, 5 innings, 5 earned. He had a very rough time of finishing his season up, and a lot of voters are considering that, especially when comparing him to Kluber. So that's something to keep in mind about Sale. A great season by far. That stat line, that seasonal stat line, is unbelievable. But the last couple of months of the season, Sale had a rocky road ahead of him, and that might end up costing him the award. Next we have Luis Severino for the Yankees, and he just had a straight-up breakout season. Last year, 3-8 record, 5.83 ERA. He actually got sent back down to the minor leagues after doing so well in 2015. So he came back up this year, and I don't think anybody really expected what he did. 14-6 record, ERA right under 3.0, 230 strikeouts in 193 1/3 innings. That is a breakout season for Severino. Unfortunately, though, those numbers compared to Sale's and Kluber's don't really compare. Sure, from a moral standpoint, from even a franchise standpoint, Severino is definitely a Cy Young Award winner. But as far as the entire league goes, just due to the seasons that Kluber and Sale had, he won't really have a say in this vote. And then, yes, finally, we get to the aforementioned Corey Kluber, a former Cy Young Award winner back in 2014. And this year, he was just quite amazing. 18-4 record, led the league in wins. 2.25 ERA, led the league in ERA, also led the league in complete games and shutouts, had 203 innings under his belt, and had 265 strikeouts. So, it is an extremely tough decision between Kluber and Sale at this point. And it all comes down to what do you value more in a pitcher. Sale led the league in strikeouts, led the league in innings pitched, but had a rough ending to the season. Therefore, had a higher ERA and cost himself a chance at winning 20 games and leading the league. Kluber, on the other hand, led the league in wins and in ERA and in complete games, but not in strikeouts and no, not in innings pitched either. So here's what I think is going to happen. I think due to the fact that the Indians are a more prevalent team than the Red Sox. They just came off making it to the World Series versus the Cubs. Although they lost in the ALDS, it doesn't matter. The Indians had so much attention this season. Also, you have to keep in mind their historic winning streak. The Indians were in the national media almost every single day in regards to baseball. The Red Sox, not really. Although they did win their division, they won it pretty easily. The Yankees gave them a bit of a nudge near the end, but everybody kind of knew going in that the Red Sox were going to win it, and nobody expected them to make it further than the ALDS, and that's just a fact. So when considering all of that, then looking at Kluber leading the league in wins and ERA, I feel that he will slightly beat Sale and win the AL Cy Young Award. Now it's time for the big awards. The MVPs, we're going back to the NL. We'll take a look at the candidates. It's Giancarlo Stanton of the Marlins, Joey Votto of the Reds, and Paul Goldschmidt of the Diamondbacks. And before we get to those three, honorable mention here to Nolan Arenado and Charlie Blackman of the Rockies. A lot of people were a bit stunned that both those guys weren't one of the finalists. Both had great seasons in their own right. So wanted to give them a bit of a shout-out before we look at the three finalists. So let's start with Goldschmidt of the Diamondbacks. By the way, he's finished second in two different MVP races in 2013 and in 2015. So something to keep in mind. But Goldschmidt this year, another monster season. 36 homers, 120 RBIs, .297 batting average, .966 OPS. That is an amazing stat line. Unfortunately for Goldschmidt, though, there are two problems. One, he hasn't won an MVP award before. I know that sounds crazy, but what I'm trying to say is that Goldschmidt, when it comes to national media attention, has always been looked at as an afterthought. He's always a second-tier player, and even though he puts up numbers of a first-tier player, he's never looked at that way. And I think this year, especially with the other two candidates being extremely strong in their own right, it's going to be very difficult for Goldschmidt to break in and win the award. Next, we have Joey Votto, and he is a sabermetric person's dream. 36 homers, 100 RBIs, very good statistics, but led the league in walks with 134, led the league in on-base percentage at .454, and tied for the league lead in OPS at 1,032. He also had 106 runs scored. The problem for Votto is the fact that he was on just a horrible team. The Reds finished last in the NL Central, losing 94 games. This was one of their worst seasons in recent memory. Now, despite that, of course, Votto still had a good year, but what did he do to help his team? The team was horrible from the beginning, it was wretched from the beginning, and it ended the same way. So it's going to be hard for Votto to convince those voters who feel that making the playoffs or being on a good team constitutes winning an MVP award. Although it has happened before. I mean, think about the Cubs, Andre Dawson, 1987. That was a last place team and Dawson still won it. I'm not saying it won't happen, but what I'm saying is that a lot more voters today have succumbed to the fact that you have to be on a good team to win an MVP award. So that's going to be a hurdle for Votto that he's going to have to jump. Then we'll get to the final candidate, and this guy really had a monster year. It's Giancarlo Stanton. 59 home runs, 132 RBIs, 1,007 OPS, .631 slugging percentage. And by the way, folks, we at least hope at this point that those 59 home runs were steroid-free, so that's very important as well. He also led the league in RBIs with 132, and as I mentioned, the slugging percentage of .631 also tops in the game. Here's Stanton's problem, and this is something that was noted multiple times by sabermetricians favoring Joey Votto. Stanton did not walk enough and struck out too much. He had 163 strikeouts, walked only 85 times, and then he had a .281 batting average, which is good, but comparing that to Votto, who hit .300, there's definitely a difference there. So who's going to win the award? That's the big question. Well, what's going to happen is this. It's going to be definitely a battle between Votto and Stanton. Goldschmidt, another good year, but he just did not have the numbers either sabermetrically or just from a total standpoint to qualify with these two players. So it's between Votto and Stanton. The question is, how many sabermetrically inclined voters are there to vote on this decision? If there are more of them, then Votto is going to win. If there are less, it'll be Stanton. But whether you're a sabermetric geek or not, here's what I say. If you hit 59 home runs in a season, purportedly steroid-free, I don't see how you cannot win the MVP award. Roger Maris won it when he hit 61. Babe Ruth won it when he hit 60. I'd be extremely shocked if Giancarlo Stanton did not win the MVP hitting 59 home runs. So I think Stanton, just because of the mere output of the audacity of his numbers, he will win the 2017 NL MVP award. So we've made it to the end, the final award to discuss. It's the AL MVP award. It's Jose Altuve from the Astros, Aaron Judge from the Yankees, and Jose Ramirez from the Indians. Those are your three finalists. Let's start with Ramirez. What a year he had. Great season in 2016. 11 homers, 76 RBIs. He hit 312. But this year, even better. 29 homers, 83 RBIs, 318 batting average, and 56 doubles that led the league. In any other season, I feel that Ramirez would have a significantly good chance at winning the award. But when he's going up against Aaron Judge and Jose Altuve, I find it very difficult for him to contend in a race like that. But still, hats off to Ramirez. He had just an excellent season, and he proved what he is really capable of on the field, now showing that he can also hit the ball out of the ballpark if needed. So now we come to the two favorites. It's Aaron Judge and Jose Altuve. Let's look at Judge. We talked about him earlier in the Rookie of the Year voting, and I said that I want to look back at his strikeout totals. Let me remind you of his stats on the season first. So 284 average, 422 on base, 627 slugging, 52 homers, led the AL, 114 RBIs. He also led the AL in runs at 128. But here's the kicker, 208 strikeouts. So here's the question. With MLB turning into a more homer-happy sport, with people deciding to uppercut more than getting base hits, it becomes a question of philosophy. Would you rather have a guy like Altuve, who hits 20 home runs but is batting 342, or would you rather have sheer power, a guy who can hit 50 home runs but strike out 208 times? Here's my personal take. If you strike out 200 times in a season, you should not be eligible to win the MVP award. Because if we went by that logic, then here are some guys who should have already won an MVP award. Adam Dunn, Mark Reynolds, and Chris Davis. And speaking of Davis, this is a perfect time to bring out the history books and take a look. So Davis, 2013 season, a breakout campaign. 53 homers, 138 RBIs, 286 batting average, all stats that are extremely similar to Aaron Judge's. But here's the kicker, 199 strikeouts, which is less than Judge's, but still just horrible. Davis that year was a favorite to win the MVP, but ended up finishing third in the race. Why? Because voters didn't like the fact that he struck out 199 times in a season. So now you look at Aaron Judge, very similar stats, 52 homers, 114 RBIs, 208 strikeouts. I cannot see a world in which the BBWAA voters decide to give him the MVP, especially when looking at that strikeout total. They haven't done it before. I don't think they're going to do it again. And then finally, we have Jose Altuve, 346 batting average, 204 hits, led the AL, 24 homers, 81 RBIs, and 112 runs scored. Now, I would say, hey, give it to Altuve, especially considering that the Astros won the World Series, but these votes were done before the postseason occurred, so it was strictly based off of regular season stats. Altuve, no. Maybe a little paltry in home runs, right? 24, even though that still is pretty good. 81 RBIs, I understand. But 346, he led the league in batting average with a 346 average. That is unheard of. The last time somebody hit over 340 in the AL was Altuve himself in 2014, and before that, Miguel Cabrera in 2013. And in the NL, that has only happened once in the past 9 years. So it's a pretty big milestone for Altuve. Combining that with the fact that he still managed to hit 24 home runs, had over 200 hits for the fourth season in a row, it makes only perfect sense that Altuve should get the award this year. Nevertheless, let's think about what the voters will do. Here's what I'm thinking. You know what? Aaron Judge will win the Rookie of the Year award, and voters will give him that. I mean, why not? 54 home runs is a big deal. But when it comes to the MVP award, as I mentioned earlier, history will tell what happens next week. Chris Davis didn't win an MVP award and had 199 strikeouts. I would find it very hard to believe that the voters would decide, oh, this time we'll give it to Judge, even though he even had more strikeouts. I think because of Altuve's track record and because of the season that he put together, he will finally get his MVP award. And before we get to our special guest, I have a bit of sad news to report. Roy Halladay, former 200-game winner, former two-time Cy Young Award winner, and former MLB All-Star Game selectee, has passed away at the age of 40 in a plane accident. It's such a shame, as Halladay was only 40 years old. He had so much of his life left to live. As far as his career goes, it was such an amazing one. He's actually on the ballot for the Hall of Fame in 2019, and I have no doubt that he'll end up making it in. His sheer output, he was such a good player. He was at the top of his game. He was at the top of Major League Baseball. So again, just a shame, and I want to extend my deepest sympathies to Halladay and his family as they go through this very difficult time. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He started his career at ESPN, hosting SportsCenter at 6, along with having his own show on ESPN Radio. Following his success there, he authored a book called Ahead of the Curve, which offers insights into baseball's sabermetric revolution. Today, he is the host of MLB Now, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, and again at 4 p.m. Eastern on MLB Network. Please welcome Brian Kenny to the show. Brian, how are you doing today, and thank you for being here on the show.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, to start, Brian, I'm going to come swinging right out of the gate and talk about the NL MVP race. Now, you are a strong proponent of Joey Votto's when it comes to this topic. So, first off, what makes you prefer Votto over Stanton? I mean, I watched your conversation with Mad Dog, and I have to say he did bring up some interesting points about Votto's candidacy.
Like, name one. Like, name one interesting point that you thought was valid.
Well, first off, he did talk about how in the second half, Votto did have a slight dip in production when talking about his power numbers specifically. Now, I know his batting average and on-base percentage stayed steady. In fact, his on-base improved, but considering that, also considering, too, that he didn't really play on a meaningful team. I mean, the Reds did lose over 90 games.
All right, so there's two things there. All right, one, right? That, because, believe me, listening to Mad Dog, it's the buckshot effect, right? you can't pick any one thing out. He's firing a shotgun at you, and there's buckshot all over. So, like, it's hard to defend one single thing. So let's pick it apart. The one thing about the meaningful games, I maintain every major league game is a meaningful game. You have to perform. Now, I would prefer my MVP candidate to be the best hitter in the league, playing shortstop, best defender in the league, and also leading his team to 115 wins and the pennant and then the World Series. I would prefer that, but it rarely happens. Giancarlo Stanton's team didn't make the playoffs. Charlie Blackmon's team played one game. So, okay, like we're splitting hairs. Was Votto's team out of the race the whole year? Yep. You know, of course. But I'm not, you know, you can keep slicing this until only the guys who are playing in the World Series are valid. So I look for the best player. I would prefer my player be on a team that's in the pennant race, of course. But you get into the nonsense zone when you start looking at that. Like for a while, for most of the year, the Marlins were not in the race. They were for a couple of weeks, and they looked decent early, if I recall correctly. But for the most part, the Marlins were not in the race. So, you know, is Stanton not eligible for the award? Like, you tell me. Like, Giancarlo Stanton, do you worry about him not playing meaningful games? Because he didn't play that many.
Well, the only thing I would counter with is that at least the Marlins were in it for a certain amount of time. I mean, as you mentioned, the Reds were
never
in it at
all. Yeah, true. Like, but right, it's for a couple of weeks. Like, you know, and then they were out of it again. So, you know, we're really not counting it. Like, we're sliding into this nebulous sort of zone of we're making it up as we go along. I hear you. It's not completely invalid that you want your guy in the race, your MVP candidate in the race. And look, by the way, let me just throw this out there. I think there's like a top five in this MVP race, or even six if you want to go to Anthony Rendon, that are completely legitimate. I'd be fine with a Charlie Blackmon vote, by the way, an Arenado vote. I think Goldschmidt is a little bit below the rest of the group, but I'm fine with that. You know, by the way, Chris Bryant had a tremendous year. Like, he surged at the end. He got involved. So he's up there. So I think there's a lot of guys that are, like, right there at the top. And I'm fine with anyone. And Stanton, of course, I'm also fine with. Because if you look at the metrics, these guys are all at the very, very top. Now, let's pick apart the other part of that. Like, please do not propagate this nonsense with looking what a guy did with his power numbers alone in the second half. Like, what did Stanton, like, what did everybody else do in a certain period of the season? I could probably find a month or 3 weeks that Giancarlo Stanton didn't hit for power. Right, I could probably find it. It's there. Charlie Blackman may never have had that this year, like in his defense. But you could almost always like find some part somewhere in the second half. Like I heard Mad Dog say that, so I looked up. I said, you know, Votto didn't hit for the same power in the second half. He didn't. But one, what does it matter? Like what you we're judging the entire season, right? Not the second half. And then two, his numbers in the second half. Votto played every single game. Did not miss a single game. So he played the entire second half, and he had a .486 on base, slugging .510. Those are monstrous numbers. Like, if I looked at his weighted runs created plus in the second half alone, he'd be among the league leaders. And that's the part that you're picking on that, hey, I think that's about, no good. I'm sorry. I'm shooting that down. It's like, you can't buy into that. That said, was Votto clearly the MVP? No, there's like five guys at the very top. I don't think there's a perfect answer because I think the best answer, the best player for the whole year, was Joey Votto by a hair over Blackman, and I'm not even over penalizing him for Coors Field. I'm also being very forgiving of his defensive metrics because I think there's some bias in the metrics against a center fielder in Colorado. And also Giancarlo Stanton is completely legitimate. I'm fine with any of those guys winning.
So to follow up, I just wanted to give you some historical information about MVP awards. Voters have given sympathy to big-time bashers, home run hitters in the past. Look at Roger Maris and Babe Ruth, Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa. So I just wanted to counter, how can you not give the award to Stanton, especially with considering how successful sluggers have been at receiving it in the past? I mean, 59 home runs, we're assuming, no steroids involved. I mean, that's a big deal.
Oh, yeah, no question. But Votto was the better offensive player. That's how he's better. Look, offense is more than home runs. You know, there's singles, doubles, walks. There's not creating outs. And if you look at run expectancy, there's a sophisticated way to look at offense. How do you affect run scoring? Joey Votto is far and away the number one hitter in the National League this year. Blackman is second, Arenado, then Goldschmidt, then Stanton. So Stanton was, by that measure, and by most measures, about the fifth best hitter in the league. Now, he had a good defensive year, too. If you look at his wins above replacement, he and Votto are about the same. He plays a more important defensive position. Votto plays first base, was actually the defensive metrics for him were quite good this year. But if you want to look at context neutral, Stanton and Votto are about the same player in terms of overall value. But offensive production, the better player is Joey Votto.
So let's shift gears the AL MVP race. I think you won that argument, Brian. But Aaron Judge and Jose Altuve are neck and neck for the award. Now, personally, I think a guy who strikes out 200 times in a season should not receive such consideration. I mean, you can attest to this, right? 2013, Chris Davis, great year, 199 strikeouts, eerily similar stat line to Judge. He finished third in that race. So what are your thoughts on this, and who has an edge in the AL MVP race?
Well, I truly try to find out who had the better season. Who was the more valuable player? Like, literally, who was the better player? Whose season would you want to have on your team? Like, if you knew the exact numbers that the guy was producing, doing the exact same thing again, and you were able to get that guy for next season, which season would you take, Altuve or Judge? And I think that's what it comes down to. I'll even keep Mike Trout out of it. I could make an argument for Mike Trout, by the way, but I won't. I've already yelled at you for Joey Votto. I don't want to yell at you for Mike Trout. But I'm completely fine with Altuve or Judge. Wins above replacement, they're about the same. WAR is an approximation. Altuve has a slight edge, 8.3 to 8.1. If you look at, you try to look at some clutch numbers, which is win probability added, who affected the winning more? Judge was not a great quote-unquote clutch player this year. Clutch does happen in the past tense. Altuve was second in the league to Mike Trout, by the way, in his offensive win probability added. You know, that said, it's a difficult call. Like, I'm really digging deep into all of this. But defensively, Judge deserves a lot of credit. He's a very good right fielder. Altuve handles the ball more, does not have the same defensive metrics at second base, but it's obviously a more vital defensive position. Altuve, where he gains the most is base running. And now it depends on how much you value base running. I happen to value base running a great deal, and I think we saw, and we're not supposed to count this, but I'm just throwing it out there. I think we saw in the playoffs exactly the players that they were. Judge is a little streakier, but able to bash you out of a game at any moment. He truly is such an impactful bat. He can change things with his bat alone. And he's also a guy who will steal home runs out of the stands. Like, he's a good fielder. So he's not some one-dimensional slugger. On the other hand, I would have to say Altuve has more ways of beating you in a given game. And I think he demonstrates that. His ability to hit for contact and run the bases, I believe, gives him an edge, even in the MVP, over Aaron Judge. But if you want to tell me Judge is a better hitter, like, I'm not even worried about his strikeouts. What's his offensive, you know, results? His offensive results are tremendous, but Altuve is right there with him in every step. And in base running and contact, there's your strikeout rate, right? Put the ball in play. That helps you more. I would give Altuve the slight edge.
So before we wrap up our talking awards, I wanted to get your input on both the Cy Young Award races. Now, in the NL, even though Kershaw led the league in wins, which I know you hate, and ERA.
I'm not even aware of that, yes.
I feel that Scherzer will win due to the fact that he actually hit the 200-inning plateau. And in the AL, I think it will ultimately come down to what voters value more, innings pitched and strikeouts, or ERA and wins once again. So what are your thoughts on both of those races?
I think Max Scherzer was the best pitcher in the game during the year. And I actually wasn't even thinking, I was thinking, right, Kershaw is there, but he just missed too many innings. And that's, you know, the argument on the other side. But Scherzer's volume and his strikeout volume, you know, it's not just his strikeout rate, but it's how often the ball's not even in play. How many innings are you actually eating? I think Scherzer was clearly the best pitcher in the National League. Like, you'd want his season. Even though Kershaw is better at preventing runs, you would want, if you could pick a season, you would say, yeah, give me Max Scherzer. Like, I want those innings. I want those strikeouts. And if it comes with a few more runs, a few more home runs, fine. If it's his ERA is a little higher than Kershaw, fine. But you would take 268 strikeouts over 200 innings. And the other race, I think Corey Kluber did enough to pass Chris Sale. I really had Chris Sale most of the year, but Kluber, you know, except for that first month, like what he did from June on. And again, I'm not trying to cherry pick. You know, early in the season counts just as much as late in the season. But I think Kluber, with his run prevention, makes up for the innings gap.
So I wanted to shift from the awards and talk about a statistic that I personally loathe as a baseball writer and fan, but I know you like it. It's being war. I wrote an article about 3 months ago disproving its effectiveness at judging players. I included the fact that Chase Utley, a player without any credentials to make the Hall of Fame, somehow has a similar war to players like Roberto Alomar and Craig Biggio. So being an advocate of war, how can you justify this?
Chase Utley is what? You're saying he's not a Hall of Fame candidate?
I don't think so. I mean, think about it. He doesn't really have any of the milestones. He doesn't even have 2,000 hits, excuse me. And I don't see him as a Hall of Fame candidate, especially when comparing him to Biggio and Alomar. Alomar over 2,800, Biggio 3,000, Biggio fifth all-time in doubles, first all-time in hit by pitch. I think there's a difference between Utley and then Biggio and Alomar. That's just my opinion, though. I wanted to get yours, though.
No, I think Utley is a solid Hall of Fame candidate. I think he was a great player at his peak. He out-hit other second basemen, with the exception of Robbie Cano once he emerged, by a wide gap. He got on base. He hit for power. He was an excellent base runner. He was actually an excellent defensive player through his peak. He's an all-around superstar. Like, I completely disagree with you on this. And wins above replacement, here's where it has immense value. In fact, I think for the exact opposite of what you're saying, is that, you know, we've, through the history of the game, paid lip service to base running and defense. And I think, like, you're more attuned to what I was saying about Jose Altuve, right? Talking about his base running and his defense.
Correct.
Right. You know why? You just saw it. Like, you just were watching it. So it's fresh in your mind. It's fresh in all our minds. Like, you see, wow, Altuve scored from first to win that one game, like, to beat the Yankees, like, on that play, right? Like, a double to the gap, and he scored from first. Like, you can see the value of it. And you're, like, so it's in your head saying, Altuve can field, Altuve can run, this guy can beat you. He's exciting to watch. He's an exhilarating player, a dynamic player. Well, that counts. That counts in beating you. And Chase Utley was that guy. Chase Utley was an excellent base runner, excellent fielder at a very difficult defensive position when there wasn't a lot of depth there, especially during his prime. And when you add up his defense and his base running to his outstanding hitting, you have what we call like an 8 or 9 win player. And that means he's a like double an all-star. He's two men, basically. He's two all-stars. You're stacking two guys up on top of each other. That's an MVP candidate. And Utley, because he played second base with defense, with base running, with power, with on-base skills, that guy was about the best player in all of baseball for about a 5 or 6 year period.
I have to respectfully disagree, but I do understand where you're coming from that. So let's circle back to your amazing journalism career. I wanted to ask how you became such a recognizable figure in sports media today. I mean, I mentioned ESPN, your book, now on MLB Network. How did it all start?
I thought it was a creative way to work. In college, I was at New York Institute of Technology, and there was a newsroom there. My sister, actually, Susie, was, you know, preceded me in college. She's 2 years older. She was at New York Tech, and she was had joined this TV newsroom, LI News Tonight, Long Island News Tonight. And look, I didn't know what I wanted to do. My father was a New York City detective. I had taken all the police tests. I was going to be a cop. Like, you have to make money. Like, we're working class. I would have loved to have gone to an Ivy League school, but it wasn't possible. I was a good student. I could write. I wasn't brilliant, but I thought I want to do something that I can apply my creative skills. I know I can write. I know I have a good understanding of things. I'm a voracious reader. What can I do? And it kind of worked perfectly into journalism. Like, you know, from where I was, it wasn't like, hey, I'm going to make movies or I'm going to make documentaries. That takes a larger vision and a little more money. But to be a journalist, I thought I can go to work for somebody and work at this craft. And, you know, just one thing led to another. I went from being a reporter right out of college to then joining the sports desk because it was a chance to get kind of a promotion. I liked sports. I mean, I always loved sports, but I really wasn't going to be a sportscaster. I was going to be, you know, a news anchor, a news reporter, a writer. It just happened that those were where the opportunities were. And so I jumped at it when I was 22 years old, and I've been a sportscaster now since 1986. So I've just always worked. You know, I worked in various TV stations. I got to ESPN in 1997, which was, you know, obviously a tremendous opportunity. It was a dream come true. I worked there 14 years. And when you're doing all of those shows and all those hours of shows, you get to, you know, work those creative muscles. And that, you know, really honed my love of baseball, my study of the history of baseball, leading into kind of sabermetrics. And I think all that knowledge and passion for baseball is what appealed to MLB Network when they came about. And when my contract was up, they were waiting.
So, finally, I wanted to get some thoughts on the horrific news that broke last night confirming the tragic death of Roy Halladay. So, in your opinion, what kind of legacy does he leave behind?
Well, he was a great pitcher. He was an all-time great, and probably, you know, at least for the next couple of decades, seems to be kind of a last of his kind. He put out volume. You know, he was a workhorse. He was quiet. He was workmanlike. He was devoted to his craft, and his dedication, his work ethic, determination, led him to lead the league in innings, you know, four different times. When he wasn't injured, he was regularly up at 240, 250 innings. And he's kind of the last of the guy that were going to do that. I know during the show yesterday, and this broke while I was here on the network, and, you know, I ran back out on the set, and we had already done our MLB Now show an hour before, but it kind of happened right after we got off the air. So we waited for confirmation, got on the air immediately. And I said, just looking at his career, he's a likely Hall of Famer. I think that's safe to say. You know, three times. I know you talk about wins above replacement, but what WAR also does for a pitcher is it tells you not just the ERA, how he was at preventing runs, but how many innings was he pitching. And he had 3 8-win seasons. You know, that's 3 years where you're an MVP candidate. He had, I think, six-win seasons, just to put it in that vernacular. In other words, he was a guy who had a low ERA for about 220 to 260 innings a year. There aren't many of those guys. And so he, I think, leaves behind a legacy. Look, it's just so, I don't know, discouraging. And yet I don't know where to land on this. Looking at his Twitter feed, you could see how much joy he found from flying. He clearly loved that. My father-in-law, my wife's father, was also a pilot, and he flew his whole life. And so I know a little bit about people who fly. They love nothing more than flying. They have to fly. They can't wait till they fly again. Clearly, Halliday loved to do that, loved the exhilaration from it. But the unfortunate part is it's also extremely dangerous, especially when you're in a plane like that where it's like sport flying and you're going to take a few more chances. And so, he was doing what he loved. He leaves us at the age of 40, but he was doing what made, in his own words, his real life better than his dreams.
Well, Brian, I want to thank you for taking time out of your day to do this.
My pleasure. And I'm sorry I yelled at you about Joey Votto and Chase Utley. But but don't listen to Mad Dog, please. Don't do that anymore.
No, I won't, for sure. Thank you.
Thank you, man. Take care.
You too. And once again, a special thank you to Brian Kenny for joining me here on the show. I had told him off the recording that I've been trying to get him on for a month, and it was just awesome to have him on and talk about all these interesting races and also honor the legacy of Roy Halladay. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Thank you all for listening. Make sure to hit us up on Twitter at Chi Talk Sports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. Make sure to look out next week as all these awards that we talked about will have winners' names. So that's something interesting to keep in mind. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.